Welcome back to the program as we turn our attention to the subject of entrepreneurship, to social capital, and to what our guest Chris Rabb calls invisible capital. Chris Rabb is a visiting researcher at Princeton University's Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs. He's a fellow at Demos and the author of Invisible Capital, How Unseen Forces Shape Entrepreneurial Opportunity. Chris, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Define what you mean by invisible capital.
Well, it's a term I coined a few years ago that represents the various forces that impact business viability or generally in life. You mentioned one of the components of invisible capital when you mentioned social capital. It also includes human and cultural capital. So human capital is essentially your skills, your training, your credentials, your education. That's pretty straightforward. But a lot of entrepreneurs don't realize that beyond knowing how to use a hammer or bake cookies or manage children, that they also need to know about bookkeeping, about other important skills that they weren't aware they needed. Social capital, as you mentioned, is your networks, your connections, who you know, but more importantly, who knows you and what they think of you. So when people find out that I'm from Chicago, for instance, a lot of people joke and say, hey, do you know President Obama? And I say, well, actually I do, and they're very surprised, and some of people are actually impressed, and I said, well, it'd be far more impressive if he knew me, because he doesn't. I really doubt that the president knows who Chris Rabb is, but I know who he is, having been in his sphere for a few years in Chicago. That's far more important, because I would have a lot more leverage if the president was referring to me like I'm referring to him right now.
Right. To what extent are things like luck and timing part of that invisible capital?
Well, you know, the challenge about luck is it's kind of like love. Everyone has their own definition, right? So some people believe that, you know, luck is divine intervention, or it's the culmination of when opportunity meets preparation. Mm-hmm. So if you play the lottery and your favorite number is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 and it comes in, but you didn't buy the ticket, is that luck? Right? So you're in the right place, but you don't have the right stuff. You're not really prepared because you didn't buy the ticket. So from an entrepreneurial perspective, what does it take to be prepared? And, you know, that's really the challenge we have in our country, because we live in an entrepreneurship-obsessed country, and yet we tend to be so very entrepreneurially illiterate. What do we need to know to be a better prepared entrepreneur? And that's really what we need. We don't need more entrepreneurs in this country. We need better prepared entrepreneurs.
And of course, though, there are those, as you say, unforeseen forces. I mean, if you're opening a new business and you've done everything right and you open the business the day before 9/11, for example,
right,
you know, your fortunes are arguably changed dramatically by things you've had no control over.
Absolutely. Well, that's the distinction between unforeseen and unseen, which is actually in the title of my book.
Right.
But they're both relevant. I really focus more on the unseen, the invisible, because we know the visible stuff, because what we think are the most important things are the ones we hear the most often from people like Donald Trump or Robert Kiyosaki of Rich Dad, Poor Dad infamy, who want you to believe that all it takes is hard work, a great idea, and a good attitude. So if you're just really positive, you can do anything. And the reality is, it's simply not true. There are wonderful, creative, smart, positive people in the world who have failed miserably, and sometimes frequently. There's not a direct correlation between those three things, individually or collectively, and your ability to create a business that will thrive. And I try to discuss why that is, what are the factors, and what we can do about it to build the type of businesses that really benefit not just the business owner, but communities and society at large.
I mean, there are those things that are part of the skill set. We all know people that are extremely entrepreneurial, just as we all know people that in many ways don't have an entrepreneurial bone in their body.
Oh, absolutely. But we have to compare apples to apples, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if, you know, this is not a book to kind of proselytize and say, oh, there's an inner entrepreneur in everyone. That's not that book. This is really a book for for three audiences. For people who self-identify as entrepreneurs, who have recently started or are considering starting a business, their loved ones, and the last component are people who advocate for entrepreneurship, whether or not they're interested in themselves. And that last group is important because they tend to be very influential. They tend to be media personalities, civic leaders, business leaders, members of kind of politically related organizations. And a lot of them believe that entrepreneurship is a silver bullet to wealth creation, to job creation, to all of these things. And we believe them because they really base a lot of their rhetoric on things that have been in the air for hundreds of years, whether it's Horatio Alger, rugged individualism, picking yourself up by your own bootstraps. But the evidence suggests that that's not really the best or most likely way that people will develop wealth, will create wealth for themselves and their families.
Mm-hmm. To what extent is there any kind of corollary to the notion of, to Adam Smith's notion of the invisible hand of the marketplace?
Well, there is a slight overlap between what I define as invisible capital and this invisible hand. But, you know, a lot of people misquote Adam Smith. He didn't necessarily believe that there was free markets in a sense that there was no responsibility of government to intervene at all, particularly to help the most vulnerable. But his invisible hand had more to do with kind of, you know how the expression, the sum is larger than the whole is
equal to the sum of its parts, right?
Exactly. Like, there are a lot of different things going on, but when you allow for these forces to happen, there's some force that is greater than all of these individual ones. And I think that that can be embraced while still acknowledging that there is great inequality and a playing field that is not quite level. And it's very obvious when you just look at basic information. So, for instance, we have 51% of our population is female, but only 28% of our businesses are owned by women. You know, that this is the 21st century. You would think that there would be greater parity between those two populations, and yet there's not. And it's not because women are being told not to start businesses or there are laws against them owning property or anything like that. It's just that it's taken a while for the quality of opportunity to be provided across the board. You know, we can very well be in a country that prizes entrepreneurship, but if we don't have a democracy of opportunity in this sphere, then we're not really having the most productive workforce that can be morphed into entrepreneurs of the future. And that's really what we want. We want anyone from any corner of society to have a good chance of failing, and in some cases succeeding, because the reality is, even if you're really smart and hardworking, the chances of you succeeding building a business of scale is really, really small.
Right. The other part is how you define that success,
right,
as you talk about, and what the objective of the business, the objective of success, really is.
That's a really good question, and I do talk about it towards the end of my book, because, you know, conventionally, our government and foundations and private enterprise, they define success in largely in four basic ways: revenues, profit, employee count, and longevity, meaning, you know, how long is your enterprise in existence in order to profit, in order to employ people. Those are the four basic metrics for success in business, but they're not enough. You could apply that to Enron or Halliburton or Blackwater or payday lenders, and they may come up very rosy in a lot of those things, but are they helping communities sustain themselves, or are they preying on communities? And I would say that if any business that does well in any of those four metrics, but it's at the great expense of local economies and specific communities, geographic or otherwise, we got to ask ourselves, is that the type of success we really want? And as entrepreneurs, are those the type of businesses that we really should be thinking about over others that may be more beneficial and create what I call, well, not what I call, but our community assets? And those are Commonwealth Enterprises, which I talk about in the book. And Commonwealth Enterprises are businesses and nonprofits that already exist that in the operation of their enterprise are building community assets, whether it's safer streets, cleaner air and water, greater literacy levels, better sense of wellness. I mean, these things may seem warm and fuzzy to us right now, but if you're living in the Gulf Coast and you don't know if you'll ever be able to drink the water that has run through rivers in your community for generations, that stuff is really important. You're not thinking about your next BMW or your summer house or something like that. You're thinking about the basics, quality of life. And a lot of people are in that position after 9/11, after Katrina. There's so many different instances where we just want to know that we're going to be able to be with our family and be able to breathe deeply and know that we are okay beyond what material possessions we'd ultimately like to have in life. And that's why Commonwealth Enterprises are a type of entrepreneurial pursuit that we as a society and our government can and should support. And daycares are a perfect example of Commonwealth Enterprises. They are actual for-profit businesses. We all know about them. Many of us as parents rely on them and are thankful that they exist, particularly mm-hmm. when we're working out of the home and we need someone to take care of our children and teach them right from wrong and how to read and write and that sort of thing and socialize with other people. Just by having quality daycare, we are actually helping people who don't have children because we're creating better workers. They're more conscientious. They're more literate. They're better. They're healthier. And that's a community asset.
The other side of that coin is how we look upon businesses that are not Commonwealth enterprises, but that traditionally have been almost in opposition to the public commons, the idea that the obligation to shareholders was somehow inconsistent with the obligation to the greater good.
Those corporations are part of what I call the entrepreneurial industrial complex, and they tend to have an agenda that wants us to believe that entrepreneurship is inherently good, and that as long as you're creating or you're maximizing profit, that's all that really matters, and that you should believe that it's just hard work, a great idea, and a good attitude. They're not going to talk about inequality. They're not going to talk about quality of life issues. They're not going to talk about fairness or democracy of opportunity. Those things are anathema to people who run or stakeholders of corporations like that. And at the end of the day, we know who those corporations are. We've been disgusted by their actions. They've either imploded or they've been bailed out or they are highly predatory. And those are the types of corporations that we do not need to be supporting with our tax dollars, and we also need to know the context in which they flourish so we can build policies that do not provide incentives for them to continue to do so, and also come up with some very cool kryptonite to make sure that they don't maintain that power. And I think one of the best forms of kryptonite for the ugliest corporations that Hollywood projects so well in, you know, as bad guys in movies, which is really based on greed, is to counter it with what I'm talking about regarding Commonwealth Enterprises. Very few people think of daycares as businesses. Mm-hmm. Very few people think of funeral homes as businesses. Yet there are certain enterprises in our communities that are just that. They employ people. They make money. And they provide goods and services that actually increase the value of kind of life itself. And I think if we focus on, if not just we focus on the businesses that are doing well, but we redefine success and we broaden how we look at entrepreneurship so it's not just about capitalistic hunger, then I think we're going to have a lot more ideas, we're going to have a lot more talent being interested in pursuing entrepreneurship, and we're going to have a far more equitable society.
it seems that both of these extremes, both of these ideas, need to move towards a more common ground, that the Commonwealth entrepreneurship needs to look towards, as you talk about, greater profit and sustainability as a result of that, and the traditional corporations that you talk about, the sort of entrepreneurial industrial complex that you refer to, needs to realize that to survive in the 21st century, it too must have a greater awareness of the public commons.
You're absolutely right. But the good news about it is this is a self-selecting audience. There are people in large corporations, stakeholders, who believe that just from a practical sustainability issue, we need to do that. So it has more to do with pragmatism than philosophy or ideology behind believing in the values. It's just looking at the bottom line in the long term. So there are businesses, large businesses, that are doing that as we speak. The ones that aren't will be dinosaurs, and that's the good news. The ones that say, well, you know, investing in people really kind of sucks, those are the folks who are not going to be around long, because as our workforce gets has more diversity of generations, like now it's like I think the first time in American history where we have four different generations working side by side, that's unheard of. We are looking at grooming a different kind of workforce that demands different things, and the employers that respond appropriately are the ones that are going to fare better. The ones that are really kind of predatory towards their own people and towards society and the economy at large, they're going to die off. Not soon enough, but they certainly will.
Why do you think they will? I agree with you that they will, but why do you think they will?
Well, you can look at it from a couple different perspectives. One is you can look at the general political appetite for the worst of the worst offenders in corporate America. And these are firms that are, you know, polluters. They have rampant discrimination of all kinds within their ranks. They produce an inferior product. Eventually, that stuff will catch up to them. So that's kind of on the practical side. On the political side, the corporations that are most ideologically opposed to equity and social change are not going to be particularly popular. They're not going to be particularly popular as soon as people know that what their politics are. We're seeing this now because the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, which represents around 300,000 businesses out of the 26 million in our country, they represent the largest businesses in America and some would say the world. They are becoming increasingly ideological. They're becoming increasingly combative regarding the current administration and any administration that gets in the way of their agenda, which is largely about concentrating wealth amongst the top 1%. And so we're seeing that there are major companies that are considering leaving the U.S. Chamber of Commerce because they're about ideology. They're about a politics that is about division. And some corporations, while still interested in maximizing shareholder value, want to do so in a non-ideological, transpartisan way. And the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, really for most of its existence, has been firmly in the back pocket of one party. Now, that doesn't mean that one party is worse than the other with regard to business, because in fact, as I write in my book, the Democrats and Republicans are equally illiterate when it comes to talking about entrepreneurship and the type of policies that are actually going to create the next generation of prepared entrepreneurs.
To what extent do you think that globalization plays a role in this? As we see, particularly in the developing world, economies come online that don't have as their baseline the kind of industrial model that we're moving out of.
Well, my book focuses more on domestic issues, but your point is valid, and that is just like individuals, certain countries have different levels of invisible capital, and in the case of developing nations, you're looking at capital markets where they don't have access to capital, they don't have access, they have oftentimes, and in most situations, they have the raw materials themselves. They may not have the depth of talent in terms of of management and experience. And so a lot of the folks, there's a lot of brain drain. A lot of the educated elite who are from formerly colonized countries will go to Europe. And what happens there is the jobs and the opportunities that they get tend to benefit the European countries, sometimes at the expense of the countries they come from. And that's because those countries don't have the invisible capital. They don't have the infrastructure and support systems and networks internally to do what's best for that country collectively in ways that the people who they've siphoned off can build opportunity for themselves and the European sponsor.
How do nonprofits fit into this? And what are we seeing in terms of really the changing face of nonprofits today?
That's a great question, because nonprofits are enterprises. They're not generating they can generate a profit, but it can't be distributed among shareholders. That's kind of the big distinction. That and many nonprofits are also tax exempt to encourage funding in ways that for-profits can't and don't. So nonprofits can operate with basic business principles just like their for-profit counterparts, and some are doing so. So, for instance, there's a new classification that has been accepted in a number of states and recognized by all 50 states called a low-profit limited liability company, or an L3C. L3Cs function like a for-profit, but they can be deemed like a nonprofit by the IRS, so that they can pursue program-related investments, which are essentially loans that some foundations provide instead of grants. So this would be the first time that some foundations in America are actually providing funds to for-profit enterprises. And the reasons they're doing that is because in order to be an L3C, you basically have to say your business is not about profit maximization, which is the assumption of that most businesses are around for. And in fact, it's for a social mission that relates to what that foundation cares about most. That's one example. If you like Sesame Street, they have a nonprofit, and the for-profit subsidiaries that they have, the revenues go back into the nonprofit to do the great work that Sesame Workshop has been doing for 30-odd years. In the city of Green Bay, the city owns the Green Bay Packers. It's the only franchise in the NFL mm-hmm. where the people own the team, not one rich family or one rich man, but an entire city. Now, that's not necessarily a nonprofit, but it is essentially a public corporation. There are a lot of different innovative structures that we need to look at. It's not about having a sole proprietorship, a mom and pop on the corner, or having, you know, Walmart. There are a lot of different options, and that's one of the reasons it's important for our civic leaders to understand kind of modern American entrepreneurship and what's working and what is the language and what are the opportunities, because that will allow us to come up with more innovative ideas on entrepreneurship, not just within it.
Chris Rabb, the book is Invisible Capital, How Unseen Forces Shape Entrepreneurial Opportunity. Chris, I thank you so much, and you have a website as well.
I do. It's invisiblecapital.com.
Chris, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.